You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 104.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. As usual, for our news update, Aaron is joining me today. How you doing, Aaron?
Good. It's been too long.
It's been way too long. I remember, well, I think this is the first time that we're talking this year. Was the last time we spoke before the new year?
I think we spoke behind the scenes about episode 100, but I haven't been on since before then.
Always been, planning new great episodes for the Local Maximum behind the scenes. A lot has happened on the show since you last checked in. I had a couple of pretty interesting interviews, one with Anthony Samaroff, who was talking about AI and robotics taking jobs or not taking your jobs, essentially the hysteria around that. I checked in with Dave Rubin on his new platform for essentially, creators getting in contact with their with their fans online and essentially building, a new forum for people, unlike, sort of as a replacement for Facebook and Twitter, at least for those, and Patreon, at least for those particular use cases. And then I did a math episode, which I'm always very proud of. So I really enjoyed doing those. Aaron, did you have a chance to check any of those out?
I did. Yeah. You covered a lot of ground. While I haven't had a chance to listen to the actual recording from the Soho Forum for Anthony Samaroff's was it an Oxford style debate?
Yeah, I think that just means, so that's always weird when I go there, because what that means is you vote beforehand and then you vote afterwards and they see who changed their mind. So you could unfairly affect the result if you lie about your initial stance, but
I suppose you could strategically vote, but that goes against the spirit of the of the exercise.
So for Anthony, there was nothing I could do to help him out because I voted for him initially and then I voted for him at the end, but there was no, in fact, and this has happened to me, if my mind has changed, then I could really hurt the person that you voted for initially.
Yeah, I guess it's a system dependent on honest feedback.
And I got a lot of really good feedback on, speaking of feedback, on the Dave Rubin episode. That's probably the biggest guest I've ever had on the show. And that was a really tight episode. I don't know if you could tell. It's like if you go on with a professional podcaster, we really did that half hour episode and it was very clean. And it was cool for me to do it because I am very good at asking questions to kind of tech entrepreneurs and people building products and things like that. And so that must be kind of a new take for someone like Dave Rubin, who is used to talking, whether it's in the political realm or to academics who've written books or, authors and things like that.
I've heard of him. I don't follow him closely, but how frequently does he put out his show or his podcast? Is that a daily thing or
it's
or
not
does
daily?
He have weekly?
No, it's okay. I think it's weekly. It's at least weekly.
Okay, so he's streamlined, but he's not so streamlined that he's Tom Wood style knocking these off one a day or multiple in a day. And
yeah, but they're more in depth, and they're usually. They're usually bigger guests in the sense gotcha. That, they're not, it's not like this show where I'll have pretty much anyone on, so one day, and so I don't want to bear too much on the logical, induction stuff, but, one day maybe we should go over that as a co-hosted show, because a lot of the times I describe these things and maybe it'll be helpful to have a co-host there. To keep me honest as I start to go through some of those concepts. That might be a fun one to do.
Yeah, I think we had a brief discussion after that episode was released, and it reminded me of back in our I guess it would be middle school days when we were learning formal two-column proofs, and without the visual aid of that format, I was starting to lose the thread as you got into some of the more complex stuff there.
Yeah, it's always hard to do it on audio.
The initial principles I was pretty good with, but by the end of the episode, I'd kind of lost the thread of where we could be going with that. So
all right.
There's definitely stuff to be revisited there.
All right, but I highly encourage everybody to listen to those last three episodes. I think that was a very strong start for the new decade. And now let's get into some of the news stories. So I want to start off with one that I want to go over quickly. And, you know, today's theme is kind of is another big data encryption one. As I was saying to you before, some of this is not going to be a very happy episode. Let's start with the first news story. This was in a coronavirus response. AI is becoming a useful tool in a global outbreak, data experts say. And I was able to peruse some of the articles. This is from Stats News, which I got through the Artificially Intelligent Podcast newsletter, which is very useful. They were using search and social media post data. So this is just publicly available data online. So it's interesting when you talk about needing people's private data to run to run machine learning algorithms, to run AI, run AI or run big data analysis. This is just using kind of public data, which I find really interesting. That sort of data wasn't available during the SARS outbreak in 2003, and they're able to track probably more accurately than other authorities can, you know, where the virus is likely spreading, how extensive it is, and how many, you know, and sort of where and how it's spreading, which I find really interesting, but also, you know, it's a really useful tool as people try to contain the spread of this virus.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see kind of a mapping side by side of the improvements between the 2003 SARS outbreak and now in terms of what data science and tracking have allowed us to do in terms of locating patient zero and monitoring spread and getting a fast turnaround versus the increased rate at which that people are traveling and the spread has our ability to use technology to track it and to potentially intervene been growing at a faster or slower rate than the rapidity with which these spread. And I guess that would not just be taking into account our behaviors, but also the evolution of the virus itself.
One of the interesting things
is a faster or slower strain than that last serious scare.
As I think back to 2003, and this is, people think the world is crazy now, but this was not a viral outbreak was not the scariest thing happening in 2003. And I guess you could say that's not the scariest thing happening in 2020. There was almost World War III, if you remember that happened. That story is feels like a million years ago, but that kind of backed up. But in 2003, it felt like World War III was around the corner. We had all those people sending – what was that white powder that people were sending?
Anthrax?
Oh, yeah. Everyone was getting anthrax in the mail. War starting all over the place, and I guess you had that SARS outbreak. But look – in 2003, the difference is, think about it, there was Google, but I don't think all of these search and posting technology, like there weren't so many people posting their personal stuff all over, you know, Twitter and Facebook and everything. There was Google, but Google did not.
That would have been pre-Facebook. Yeah. It would have been pre-smartphone.
Pre-Twitter. And Google did not have the kind of data set to aggregate their search data back then either, which has been a huge boon to kind of data science studies.
Yeah, it's definitely a different world, and it feels like we travel with a lot more ease and freedom now than we did then. But there hasn't been, I can't think of a single major transportation innovation between then and now that would have dramatically changed that.
Internet on the planes sometimes when it works.
Right, but that's not going to make it that would have no influence on the speed with which the virus is going to
yeah, no.
going to disperse.
Yeah. No, I don't know if, yeah, I don't know if that's a factor. Probably not. Although people look, China is way richer than it was in 2003 and 2000. And the difference in China must be far greater than the difference here in the United States or here in the West. So I would imagine there's a lot more people in China that have the means to travel now than did 20 years ago.
Well, that may be true. That yeah, there's a lot more internal movement there, and so that that may be part of what allowed it to kind of get out of control, out of that single province, in a way that it wouldn't have a decade or 2 decades ago.
So, did you know this? The city of Wuhan. Did you hear of the city of Wuhan? Have you heard of it before the outbreak of be honest. Have you heard of the city of Wuhan before the coronavirus outbreak?
Nothing that sticks in my mind. It may have been something I've heard, but I would have substituted it with generic Asian city in my brain.
Same here. Same here. The city.
Partially because I never know how to pronounce the names of Chinese cities. Because of the way that they're, what is it? Is it called transliteration?
Yeah, I mean,
they convert it into English characters.
I'm sure I could name 5 or 6 Chinese cities, but Wuhan wouldn't have been at the top of my list. But
no, it's not high up there.
But listen,
and it is indeed a city, not a province, correct?
It's a city, but this will blow your mind. It's larger in population than New York City.
That doesn't surprise me, only because I'm sure that there are dozens, if not more, cities in China that you could say that about.
That no one's heard of. It's
yeah.
It's crazy how high the population is over there.
Well, they've got a billion plus people. They got to put them somewhere.
yeah, that's true. Okay. So the next article that we want to go on, if we're, I mean, we could do more about this virus, but I'm not an expert on it, and we have other depressing stories to tell. But no. Okay, so Gizmodo has this article about self-driving cars, and it says your next car will be watching you more than it's watching the road. And so you sent me that article. That was an interesting one. And what I got out of it was the attitude of the article was, hey, understanding what's going on outside the car, that's too hard of a problem. You know, there's all these animals and pedestrians and different kinds of roads. We don't, in conditions, we don't know what's going on. But you know what? All of this research and development was not done needlessly. We are going to point the cameras and the tech inside to you, the driver and the passenger, mostly to make sure that you don't do anything dumb. Isn't that great?
They kind of have a point there, because there's only so much you can do to control for the other idiots on the road, but the idiot inside your own car, there's a lot they can do to control for that.
Hmm. So I don't drive.
And actually, some of these systems are in place already. I know when I recently purchased a vehicle, and I didn't end up with this system in my car, but one of the systems that I was reading about, it has cameras that are watching the driver and looking for signs of drowsiness and distractedness, and if it thinks that your attentiveness to the road is waning, it does some sort of alert to refocus you. And they probably can more efficiently and more effectively reduce accidents with that approach than like I said, trying to worry about the other unpredictable cars on the road around you.
So yeah, I don't drive very much. I'm very grateful for some of the safety features when I do drive, because I'm not a very experienced driver. So it helps me stay within the lines, and it tells me when the seatbelt is off. But I definitely notice there are times when they overdo it, and it actually makes things more dangerous, like when things are beeping and buzzing and you can't really tell why. And also the terrible user interface on the GPS device and the phone Bluetooth hookups. I mean, this could just be because I'm using crappy cars with a zip car.
Yeah. So 2 things on that. One, yeah. The built-in interfaces tend to be pretty lackluster. And that's an area where Android Auto and Apple, what is it, Apple CarPlay?
There's Apple CarPlay, yeah.
Those two interfaces are far and away the leaders, because as long as the manufacturer complies to whatever standard they set for compatibility, it's going to be better than the built-in system that the manufacturer provides.
Yeah, but think of how dangerous that is when that's not working, when someone's trying to get that working and that's not working. I know you're supposed to pull over and figure it out, but there's going to be a lot of people who don't.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and the
or they
the
think it's going to be easy, so they're like, is, you can get in trouble really easy because you think it's going to be easy. You think you're going to put something, you really want to watch the local, listen to the local maximum. You're going to put it on your car. You're going to click it. It's going to happen in 5 seconds. But then it's like difficult. And you have to touch all those things, and pretty before you know it, your eyes are off the road. Don't do that, folks.
Yeah, well, and that's another place where. The voice interface for some of those things is it's getting better and better to minimize the amount of actual touchscreen interface you need to have.
Yeah, but it's slow going.
But the other thing you mentioned was all the buzzes and beeps and everything, that the default settings for a lot of these are suboptimal. And it has the same problem that we do with your Facebook privacy settings, that 90-something percent of people are never going to go in and change the defaults.
Yeah.
So however it comes set from the factory is likely what you're going to get. You can fine-tune a lot of that, but you need to kind of be a – maybe not a super user, but very aware of your options to actually go in and mess with that and get it to the way you like it. And then, of course, what happens when somebody else – hops into the driver's seat and you've tuned it one way and they're expecting it another way.
Well, that's
that's something that there is the ability to set profiles, but I don't know how much of that stuff is tied to a driver profile. And then again, it's who's going to take the time to program all that in for multiple users.
Right. It's not like, and you think they're going to have a good interface for transporting your profile between cars. I don't think so.
Yeah, well, so
they don't
so
have a very good track record on that stuff.
For your media interface, so you know your podcast player and your phone, preferred GPS app, that stuff is all pretty portable with Android Auto or Apple CarPlay. But how I want my my cruise control and my lane assist to work, that is not portable currently, at least not easily. And I think it's going to be a long time before we see portability for those kind of features, which are much more tied in to the specific hardware of the vehicle than your media interface experience.
So this article says that they're going to detect your drowsiness. They're going to see if your eyes are blinking. They're going to look at your steering behavior, and then they're going to come on and talk to you. A voice, a disembodied voice, is going to come on to talk to you. It'll recommend that you play music or pull over.
With all the things we say to Siri and Alexa, we can't complain about a disembodied voice. Yeah. That's become a given.
Yeah, I'm not complaining about it. I'm just describing it. Aaron, if the car tells you to pull over because it thinks you're tired, what are you going to do?
I will give it consideration, but the car is not the boss of me, which is true until the car is the boss of me. And this is something
that in a
different context, when they started putting OnStar in vehicles, that means that somebody has the ability to remotely control your vehicle. They can basically force the vehicle to slow down and pull over to the side of the road, whether you want to or not, when you're behind the wheel. And they say that the main use for that is if your vehicle is stolen and involved in a high speed police chase, they can power it down and safely pull it off to the side of the road. But I'm not super comfortable with the idea that someone outside my vehicle has that kind of control. And similarly, I wouldn't be super comfortable with someone inside the vehicle who's not me having that kind of control, whether it's a creepy person sitting in the back seat or this disembodied voice, the AI that's decided that you're not listening to my advice to pull off because you're drowsy. So I'm going to do it for you and disable the vehicle. It gives me the creeps. And there's also the question of, can your car be forced to testify against you? If I get into an accident and they pull the car logs,
that was in a movie.
Oh, Aaron was distracted. Aaron was sleep deprived, and we warned him, but he didn't listen. So he's entirely liable, and the insurance isn't going to cover anything. Or he got into the car, and he was clearly showing signs of intoxication. We can't prove it because we don't have a blood sample, and we didn't do a road sobriety test. But the video inside your own vehicle is going to rat you out for something like that. That I'm not comfortable with.
So there was a movie from 2011 called Horrible Bosses. I don't know if you remember that.
I did not see that, but I remember seeing trailers.
Right, it was with Kevin Spacey when he was still popular, and Jennifer Aniston, who's always popular, and some other good comedians. And I think at the end, their car saved them because the car provided the evidence that they were doing illegal stuff against their bosses, but apparently the car provided evidence that they were innocent of whatever they were going to be, or you know, whatever they were going to be accused of. So hey, sometimes the movies that are prescient come from very strange places. Okay, so one of the controversial things here that the article mentions is that hey, your recorded conversations, your video, your image, your likeness, the same issues that we have around the Amazon Alexa, and the same issues.
Yeah, and we even talked about this in the context of cars. I think was it Uber or Lyft that was talking about that they're going to now be recording passenger, you know, interactions in the vehicle.
So right. So
what can be done with that data?
So they're going to have to send that remotely in order to train the algorithm. And they say at the end something like, "Oh no, it's okay. We have this system called Edge AI." Which is a system which means that it can like detect all the things about you. It can detect like your drowsiness and all that locally. So it doesn't have to send it to the cloud. It doesn't have to send that remotely. But my point is right. They also have to train an algorithm. And you can't train locally because you have to aggregate data from everybody in order to do that into one centralized place. And in order to do that, you're going to have to send some data over the cloud, and it's going to be, they say it could be encrypted, but as we'll see in a little bit, that encryption may only go so far.
Yeah. Well, so the idea of edge AI, this really comes out of an industrial context where in a lot of factories they've been doing for a while now, where they don't want to have to send all their data up to the cloud, not so much because they're concerned about security as much as it is a speed issue, that they want to be able to do this kind of analysis and learning on the factory floor without having to send it to, you know, Amazon Web Services or whatever. But they don't want to have it built into each individual robot on the factory floor. They want to have it on the edge of their local cloud, so to speak. And so that makes sense in that context. With the question of training data, I think this is going to be a lot like the ubiquitous pop-up option you get when you install something, where it says, do you want to opt out of the Google or Microsoft or Amazon, customer experience improvement plan, which basically means, can we use all your data to continuously retrain our algorithms? And most people, because the default option is yes, use my data, are going to click OK. And continue to volunteer that information.
They make you feel like such a freeloader if you click no.
It's like when you say no to cookies, or you tell, I think you can elect to have, Facebook not use identifying information for advertising. And so you just get, random generic ads in that case. And the thought is, well, my experience is less quality in exchange for not giving letting them use my info. Do I want the lower quality experience here?
Yeah, they're going to need data from a lot of different users and a lot of different faces in order to get this to work, as they say in the article. So yes, it can detect your drowsiness or whatever it wants to detect. I don't know, maybe it'll detect if someone's angry or something like that. Yes, it could do that detection right there in the car, but in order to train the model and send the data of the model down, it's going to need a whole bunch of recordings and a whole bunch of of video and audio, and whatever other sensors they put in there. So okay, interesting story. Finally, sort of to bring together, this is kind of the central theme of the show today, which is Congress and encryption. So the good news is that Congress is tied up in impeachment right now, so they might not be trampling on the people's rights as much. So I hope this impeachment trial just keeps going on and on, and we talk, so-and-so going to testify?
I haven't looked at Metaculus recently, but I'm sure there's some predictions on there for how long impeachment hearings in the Senate are going to last.
Just get everyone to testify, everyone in the country. So there is a bill that's going through Congress, and there was a bunch of articles about this last year in December, but the bill is still kind of making its way through. So there's been kind of worry that it would go through.
My understanding is that the bill has not been brought to the floor, it's still very much in draft form, but everybody's talking about it.
No, but there's no real opposition to it yet. I mean, the Republicans support it, the Democrats support it, the executive branch supports it. And I say executive branch because I don't know what Trump thinks, but the Attorney General.
I think we're right to be concerned about that. However, I will caveat it with the consideration that until there actually is a bill, it's real easy to say that there's bipartisan support, because the way it's been pitched is, well, we're doing this to stop child pornography or XYZ. And nobody's going to come out and say, well, I don't know, I think we need to step back and maybe lighten up a little bit on child pornography. When you present it that way, everybody's in favor. Until we see an actual text of the bill, it's going to be really hard to get people to at least politicians, to come out against it. That being said, I think there are going to be people from both sides of the aisle, from both branches of government here, and I'm leaving the judiciary out of it because they'll deal with it down the road, who are going to support this no matter what the form of the text comes out.
Yeah, and this is one that I think that the people in general, if you polled them, would not support, unless it was like kind of a one of those push polls where it's like,
yeah, it depends how you word it.
Yeah, exactly.
And what they're going to give it,
it's
a
sneaky, like, hey, if we don't
a name
if,
that makes it seem very reasonable.
So let's say what it is. So first of all, it's essentially telling companies that they can't use real irreversible encryption. True encryption means that, hey, if I don't have the key to decrypt, if I don't have the information I need to decrypt this file, it just looks like random noise. But what they're saying is, no, the government essentially needs a backdoor or
And what seems to have prompted this was the talk maybe middle of last year, early last year, that Facebook was going to put full end-to-end robust encryption into WhatsApp, which previously there was some, but not this level of end-to-end, which basically means that Facebook as a corporation doesn't have the ability to reveal what the communication within the app is. That previously there was a link in the chain, basically, where with the right tools they could unveil what was being exchanged by putting in proper encryption. They no longer have the ability to do that, whether they want to or not.
Right. It's not just don't be evil, it's can't be evil. And so it's, look, with all of the breaches, it's hard to make the case, hey, you should have nothing to hide, from all your communications on the internet, because, we need this to catch criminals. But look, if there's a back door, then criminals can also get your data. If your car is sending videos and audio to you, somebody else, and sending that, for the reasonable purpose of training a model, then somebody maybe could intercept that and get that information. Or if you remember a few years ago, there was this iCloud leak, and this is Apple, this is not some random company, but all these celebrity private photos were just leaked and went out to the whole world. And so that could happen to anyone. And so it really is a big deal. And I sort of contrast this with the gun control issue, where people really care about, hey, these are my rights and you're not taking it away. With the encryption issue, it seems like people who think that way in the gun issue are just not, I mean, I actually think there are a lot of people who think that way in the gun issue who think similarly on the encryption issue. But in Washington, I'm not assured that they are going to stand as firm.
Yeah, I think part of it is that most people in Washington don't understand how encryption works. They also can't wrap their hands around why we don't trust them with this backdoor.
But they do understand.
It's just bad ideas all around.
They do understand why people might not trust the police or government agents, which is also them. but they don't, I mean, they understand it because there's a huge constituency, you know, making sure that they understand it. You know, there's a gun lobby, but there really isn't an encryption lobby. I'm sort of, you know, I'm positive. It's a positive note that some of these companies are actually pushing back and trying to build these encryption systems, but I don't know how much of a backbone they're really going to have in the long run.
Yeah, it's very, very disconcerting that I don't know how firm these companies are going to stand on this, because what they're really threatening is to take away their immunity from prosecution for some of these things. And when they open those floodgates, it's going to become a dollars and cents issue more than a principled stand. And a lot of these companies will not put principle over cash flow in that case.
Yeah.
Especially when the government is putting their thumb on the scale.
Yeah, yeah. And they say, hey, we need this to catch criminals. We need this to... It's the same arguments as for gun control, but it doesn't seem... And even some of the same politics... I assume Lindsey Graham is pro-Second Amendment. I could be wrong about that.
I believe so. Yeah. At least he gives lip service to it.
Okay, yeah. And you know, the attorney general is in on this too, and it's just like, yeah, we're gonna catch, you know, one criminal because something really bad happened, and same argument.
The attorney general is certainly taking the pro law enforcement stance here more than a principled policy stance in any sense, and I'm a firm believer that it is not my job nor the job of any of these tech companies to make the job of law enforcement easier.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things that we could do that would make it easier to throw people in jail, and that's not a good argument for anything.
Yeah, well, I agree. Naomi Brockwell, who's been on this show, had a really good video out on this in December on Twitter. So I will link to that. What you also posted these Boar Patch articles. Can you just say briefly what those are?
Yeah, so Boar Patch is somebody that I've been reading for probably over a decade now, and among some of the topics he writes about, internet security or information security is a big one of them. I believe back in his youth he worked for a three-letter agency in the greater DC area, and one of the things that he's covered numerous times is how there is. Depending on how you read the information, evidence might be too strong a term, but there is a very strong indication that the NSA actively worked to get vulnerable, weakened encryption algorithms into commonly used standards so that it would be easier for them to then go and crack communications. And so the end result is that there was some bad encryption tools out there. And there's now no reason that we should ever trust the government when they tell us that we should do XYZ on encryption, because they've proven to not have public interest in mind when they're doing that.
So, yeah. So when you say that the politicians can't wrap their minds around what encryption is, what do you think their main misconception is?
There's a saying when analyzing a policy, a law that you're looking to pass is, don't think about what your party would do with it or your administration. Think about what the opposition would do when they get into power and have the ability to use this tool. Think about what your worst enemy would do with this, not your closest allies. And that's a good way to think of an encryption backdoor, because whether it's what the other party would do or what the Russians would do or, criminal hackers would do with this information, because once it's been constructed, once it's been built, once you put the weakness or the hole or the backdoor in there, you can't control who's able to utilize it. So there's some concerns about potentially issues with email encryption and email security. Imagine, if you will, a tool that allows them to go in and read anybody's email through some sort of backdoor.
That might exist. According to Naomi Brockwell, which she's citing Edward Snowden. Apparently, there are servers built by Amazon that have people's emails and SMS communications, and it's actually able to be accessed by real people.
Yeah, well, so as a thought experiment, I'm going a little bit off the beaten path here, but if we imagine for a moment that there is a backdoor that allows reading of all emails, you've got access to that server, you've got access to the digital record. If you can read it, what's to say you can't modify it? And if you think that the release of DNC emails by a Russian or Ukrainian hacker in our last election was a big brouhaha, imagine if they had the ability to not just release information, but to go in and alter that information and for those alterations to be completely undetectable. And now they're not just releasing emails, they're writing emails from people.
Yeah.
Emails that we can't prove were never sent. It's a whole nother form of deep fake, because we put a hole in there because somebody wanted to be able to access it. And I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but you can't put the genie back in the bottle with this type of stuff. And we fought this battle back in the 90s. And when I say we, I mean the tech industry, because we were both too young to really be aware of what was going on with this in the early 90s. But encryption was classified as a munition by the U.S. government.
A
ITAR-controlled munition.
What does that mean?
So you could not... It was considered a weapon of war during the Cold War. You could not export encryption algorithms outside the U.S. without permission from the State Department.
This shit needs to be in the Constitution of the United States that people are allowed to use encryption.
It literally boiled down to, a couple of lines of code. If you brought that from the U.S. to Canada without permission from the State Department, that was a federal crime. And there were people who literally took certain encryption algorithms, printed them out onto reams of paper, put them in a suitcase and flew out of the U.S. committing felonies because they believed that that information needed to be free. And so the U.S. government functionally lost that battle, but they took the stance for many years that this encryption is so dangerous that we can't let people outside of the government have control of it and access to it.
It seems like it should almost be folded under free speech, but
that was definitely the argument they were making. And you see that in some other realms now that code is speech.
Yeah.
And so you can't restrict code.
If they say money is speech, then code is definitely speech.
Yeah.
Okay. So this reminds me of a story just from today at work that is totally related to this. I had to set up a new collection on Amazon, basically to upload some files. They're kind of files that should be publicly available. So for my particular use case, I wasn't too worried about the permissions and all this. But I went to the page where I had to set up permissions for Amazon's cloud service, and it was totally unintelligible. I had to get an expert come down and tell me how to set it up. We had to look through all sorts of things. And then somebody slacked.
In terms of legalese or the technical aspects?
The technical aspects of it. Like if they say like, hey, do you want to make this public? And you check it, it means something other than what you think it means. And who is the principal and what's the it's like they have a whole different language that you have to learn in order to use their privacy. It's like 1,000 times more difficult than Facebook, because imagine Facebook's privacy controls, but written for engineers who have been in this world for many, many years, and just increase in complexity. And I've seen on Twitter, I looked on Twitter, I was like, this is crazy. And someone said on Twitter, someone said, I'll have to look up the particular tweet, I'll post it. But they said, with the privacy controls this complex, it's crazy that companies aren't leaking data left and right. And then everyone responded, oh, they are.
Yeah.
So it's not as simple as, Amazon will keep it private and Amazon won't make a mistake. Sometimes the people setting up the privacy, not everyone at every company is going to be an expert at setting up the privacy controls in Amazon to begin with, even if Amazon doesn't make a mistake.
Yeah, well, as bad as it is in cases like that, at least people are thinking about it, because I'm going to call back to something that Borpatch has railed on for years. In the Internet of Things, in all your connected devices, the issue hasn't so much been bad security. It's been that they haven't even considered security. Mm. And we're starting to see improvements there.
It has to be easy for it to work.
But yeah, it's the things as simple as, there's no way to provide a patch or an update to this device. So that means that when that firmware was frozen, you know, maybe years before the actual device hit the market, and there was a vulnerability in it, well, you're stuck with that forever.
Yeah.
And when that's, you know, a device that's connected to your home network, that's connected to your electronic door locks and your, you know, high definition security cameras in your house, that's not okay.
Yeah. So, in line with
in your car,
aligned with the media and political assault on privacy and on encryption, another day, another dumb article from the New York Times. This time it's FUD, it's fear, uncertainty, tout on Bitcoin. Just an absolute crap show of an article. I do follow the author of the article on Twitter. I don't know why, but maybe he wrote something good in the past. But
Mr. Popper?
Yeah. So they say the thing is like, oh, you know, Bitcoin use is declining, and really the only use case that isn't declining is the black market. I mean, that's essentially the headline. Let me actually get the full headline here so I can see. Yes, Bitcoin has lost steam, but criminals still love it. With the subheadline.
You know what this makes me think of?
Well, hold on, let me read the subheadline. The subheadline is, the police hope that taking down online black markets would chase away criminals, but the amount of Bitcoin spent in illegal purposes has reached a new high. Sorry, go ahead.
So a couple of years back, India had some sort of initiative where they basically recalled all their high denomination bills and replaced them with new ones.
Yeah, I think we mentioned it on the show. I think we covered it.
Because the concern was that only criminals are using these large bills. And you hear that in the U.S. to some extent, too, with, like, nobody carries around for casual spending, really, things bigger than 20s. So maybe we should get rid of, you know, the 100, the $500,000 bills, because really all that serves is to help drug dealers move large amounts of cash in duffel bags instead of dump trucks.
They've never been to Peter Luger's Steakhouse, I'll tell you that.
but yeah, this idea that Bitcoin is really only serving the black market is, have you seen cash? Because
so a lot of the claims in the article are contradicted by other facts given in the article and contradicted by the links they put in the article, which they say support one thing, and then you see a link and you're like, oh, they have data.
A, they don't expect you to read the article, and B, much like apparently Paul Krugman is guilty of this, he doesn't expect you to follow the link and read the article that he's citing.
But this is the New York Times, for Christ's sake. They got to do better than that.
Well, I mean, isn't that where Krugman publishes?
It is.
But so clearly we've discovered their underlying editorial.
But I've never been. I always have. I know it's, as much as I rip on the New York Times, I don't know, as much as they disappoint me again and again, I still have like respect for the name, the New York Times. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't go away.
That's the Dunning-Kruger effect in full fledge.
How so?
I believe it's Dunning-Kruger is where you read an article on something you're an expert in, and they get everything not just wrong, but like diametrically opposed to the truth. And you say, oh, these guys are fools, complete idiots. And then you turn from the technology section to the politics section, and you expect the person writing that section to be fully knowledgeable about everything they're writing about, as if you're reading a completely different publication.
Yeah.
The level
I thought
of
Dunning-Kruger of was
incorrectness is uniform. We just only are able to recognize it in areas where we have expertise.
I thought Dunning-Kruger was when you you know a little and you think you know a lot, and then you know a lot and you think you know a little, or is that something else? Or is that Gell-Mann?
You know what? I'm confusing Dunning-Kruger and is it Gell-Mann?
Something like that.
Amnesia?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I know we mentioned them before. I have to look it up to make sure I get it right.
Yeah, yeah. No, but it's just I feel like the New York Times, as a name, should carry weight. But anyway, I've been hearing this crap for 7 years that Bitcoin, you know, is only for criminals. First of all, they're like, oh, the price has continued to decline. Price and usage has continued to decline, and they always pick the most convenient spots to check. So in the past year, the price has gone from 3,000. All the way up to 14,000, all the way down to 7,000. And then they're like, oh, look, it went from 13,000 to 7,000. That's bad. But you know what? It was only up at 13,000 for like a week. And then it's always been in like for a while, it was in the 10,000 range. It's already back up to like 9,000. In fact, it just went on a tear the day after this article came out. So they really have no, they just have no like sense of perspective on this thing. They also another example where they contradict the headline is it also says, well, Bitcoin is not that great for organized crime because, you know, it can be tracked. So they're really talking about petty crime. They also said Venezuela has leveled off. Yeah. And then they look at they click to the graph and it's like, yeah, Venezuela has leveled off after shooting up tremendously. And then it's leveled off didn't go back to where it was before that before usage in Venezuela shot up. So that just saying, use is leveled off as Venezuela does not give the impression, like the graph that I would have drawn from the article is not the graph that is posted. So these things, I mean, I know it's a flash in the pan. There's all this crazy articles about Bitcoin out, but, I still expect more from the New York Times, even after all these years. I'm sorry. I don't know when I'll get over that. But maybe it's because I read the New York Times archive so much that I use it to get historical information that, I find that useful.
Yeah, I wonder how much our perspective on them as an authority in years past is rose-colored glasses, or if these issues have been ever present.
Some of it is, but it's still helpful to go back if you want to find out what people are talking about in like the 1900s or the 1800s. And I've definitely seen some dumb articles in the archive, but I guess, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe.
Well, to reiterate your point about kind of the sliding time window,
yeah.
and cherry picking the time scale you're looking at, you could do the same thing with the markets in general. That I think I saw a newsletter come out right after the first of the year talking about how, you know, such and such a fund has had an amazing 2019, you know, with like better than 25% returns, but then they tempered it with, don't take that too seriously, though, because 2019 was a really good year. But if you look at the average over 2019 and 2018, it turns out we're actually just pretty much on par with, you know, whatever the Dow has been doing for the last 50 years, because 2018 was a really bad year.
Yeah.
And so it happens that arbitrarily the calendar year for 2019 fell in such a way that we were able to chop off all those losses and only look at the gains. But You can't. Nothing happens in isolation.
Yeah. Also, I think, and I'm not going to get into the details on this, but they say like usage of Bitcoin by individuals has gone down. You could point to a few like, you know, particular online shops that no longer accept that, but I don't think that's true. That individual usage is down. They don't really have very good data on that. It seems to be up. It seems to.
Yeah, I'd be very curious how they're measuring that, how they're making that determination.
Yeah, and now with Jack Dorsey trying to introduce it into Square and whole governments being interested in it, I don't know. I feel like that's just sloppy journalism.
How you measure the movement of currency like that is a very interesting question. How you measure the movement of any good like that is an interesting question,
yeah.
But particularly currency and especially something that's somewhat anonymized like Bitcoin is. I suppose you can get some numbers on volume and volatility, but tying that to individuals, I expect, is very tricky.
Yeah, and they have...
They must be using some sort of surrogate statistics there.
You could see the number of transactions, but you don't know what all of those transactions are. You know, most of them are people moving around their own money, so trying to get out the actual right. And also, like, a lot of transactions now are through the Lightning Network and other side chains where they're not even registered on the blockchain.
So that's not being counted?
Yeah.
So it's like tracking podcast download numbers. That if you're not doing it all through a single source, then you're losing data there.
A little like that. A little like that. Very tough when you're trying to sell advertising. All right. Any last thoughts today? I have a few. I don't know if you have a few.
Well, hit me with yours.
No, I just feel that I'm really starting to understand the issue of encryption and data, and the fact that I feel like we're kind of being manipulated by certain groups to kind of turn against this idea of encryption and privacy. And it's like, you know, hey, you should have nothing to hide, and we really need it. And you see that in the Bitcoin article. You see that in this bill that Congress is trying to put out. You know, big data has a lot of positive things associated with it. Maybe it could prevent car accidents, even though, it's kind of creepy that it's like looking in at you. And if we don't have proper encryption, then people can just find you. Like they found it for the Nest data. Big data is being used to fight this SARS outbreak. So again, technology is a double-edged sword. But just give people the freedom to use it, to broadcast what they want, and to encrypt what they want. And the outcome would certainly be better than it otherwise would be if you remove encryption.
Yeah, I don't know what I can do as a private individual to fight this war on encryption, to try and stop some of these bills from getting through.
You could be more careful yourself in your own use.
But yeah, I need to give some serious thought to what I can do in my personal life and my actions to improve my personal information security.
And I'll be honest, if someone did an audit of my security, I probably would not come out very looking very good in that.
Yeah, well, and I think one of the big issues with WhatsApp moving to end-to-end encryption is a concern for those in the law enforcement and intelligence community. There's a very small portion of people now who use serious encryption, you know, end-to-end encryption for communications, and it's such a small group that basically when you do it, you're raising a red flag over yourself, saying, "Look at me, I have something to hide," and then they can go and do metadata attacks and try and insert man in the middle attacks, and find ways to break that. But all of a sudden, if by default everybody is using end-to-end encryption, they have no way to tell the people who are hiding something from the people who are just using proper encryption. And that scares law enforcement, because the best type of security is security in anonymity. And if everybody is using this level of encryption, all of a sudden you disappear into that crowd. So I think that's a big part of what's going on here, that they were able to work around it because so few people were really cranking things up to 11 in terms of security, that it put them under a microscope, and they don't want that equation to flip in terms of kind of the Pareto rule, where
is that's the 80-20 rule.
The simplified 80-20, there's a very small portion of people who are using encryption, but they're the ones that you've got to be watching, and if it flips to everybody's doing it, you can't possibly watch that portion of people.
Yeah, well, I hope it gets to that. I don't want, as the world becomes increasingly digital, I don't want everything you say to be, intercepted and possibly used against you. I mean, think about how many personal conversations you had where you said something you wish you didn't say. Fortunately, that's a personal conversation. You might have to apologize to one person. I wouldn't like that to be that to be the norm, that just everything is put out there. Human beings, human interactions are not naturally meant to be that way, in my view.
Yeah, the Fourth Amendment has been trampled enough, and as difficult it is to claw rights back, this is one area where we can try to do a little bit.
All right. Aaron, thanks for joining me today. Hope we have a few good things to get into in future episodes. So I hope you'll join me to that. I'm not going to like say what they are.
But yeah, we really need an uplifting episode after all this doom and gloom. So we'll go out seeking positive news stories.
Yes, yes. And man, I have I spoke to a mathematician this week in England. Her name was Sophie Carr. She was actually in a competition and voted the most interesting mathematician in the world. So I interviewed her. She's a Bayesian.
Does that mean she's going to get a Dos Equis commercial?
I don't know, but she definitely got a spot on the Local Maximum because she is a huge Bayesian and talks about Bayesian inference all the time. So I had a really great conversation with her. She made a analogy between Bayesian inference and a popular board game with children. I'm not going to say what it is, but you can listen in. And so that's going to be next week. I'm very excited about that. All right. So,
well, I'll be listening with eager ears.
All right. Wonderful. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com if you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show. Send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account at Max Sklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.